Welcome back to those who have been on various sorts of journeys. And greetings to the Sangha. It's good to see you again in this mode after being in Kaivalya cocoon for some days, preparing for this intensive seminar, which has an outrageous and horrifying title. It's much too long for me to remember. Purusha, what's the title? You can read it.
Mastering one concept will bring complete fulfillment and freedom from all suffering.
What concept could that be? You know, it's very interesting. I'll bet all of you have an idea of what I'm going to say, what concept it is. How many think you already know the concept? And, you know, I'm just going to... Yeah? What do you think it is?
The concept of Shiva.
Okay. That's certainly relevant, but no, not quite it. And who else?
Ah. No concept.
What is it?
No concept.
Ah, that's very close. I like that. Very good. Yes?
Shunyata.
Shunyata. Well, that's very close to my non-existent heart, so yes. Emptiness, indeed, is an important concept. Anyone else?
I.
Oh, I like I. Very good. Anyone else?
Silencing the mind.
That's definitely a concept of a certain nature that is essential to grokking the real. So yes, absolutely. I thought you were going to say the nectar of immortality, which would also be a very important concept.
Non-existence.
A very important aspect of reality, indeed.
Non-identification.
Excellent. A very important aspect of our sadhana in order to realize that ultimate reality. Yes?
Swaha,
of course. Everything has to be complete and sacrificed into the fire. And that's a very important part of what I'm going to be talking about today and through this weekend, I think. Here's what happened. Until this morning, I was sure of what I was going to talk about. And then this morning, I fell into an abyss. And I realized, no, everything I had prepared, I had to throw out. Why? I made the mistake of asking myself, but what is a concept? What if somebody asked me what a concept is? And then suddenly I realized that everything I had thought was built on, you know, some false platform. Because it is not clear to the ego mind what a concept actually is. And so I had to go into a whole meditation into that concept of the concept. And so what I came out with is, well, first of all, that we tend to confuse the signifier of a concept with the concept itself. Right? A word is not a concept. A word signifies or attempts to signify a concept, but a concept itself is in the signified. And signifiers are never adequate as concepts, for one thing, because there's always some wiggle room as to the meaning of any signifier. Signifiers, as we know, slide under the signified. And I was thinking of the concept as developed by a post-structural philosopher named Gilles Deleuze, who was famous in his last great book with his partner Félix Guattari called What is Philosophy? He said, philosophy is the creation of concepts, new concepts. But then he said, and yet I can't define what a concept is because a concept has no being. It only has becoming. And whatever signifiers you use to try to pin down the meaning of something will never quite stay because your perspective is going to shift. The more that you learn, the more depth that your consciousness has, the same signifier will begin to signify deeper nuances of the real. So I want to start out with a pseudo-definition that a concept is an inevitably inadequate attempt. Maybe you should write this on the board, Swati, if you want to, or else just write it in your notebook and then we'll share it later. But it's an inevitably inadequate attempt via signifiers to express an encounter with the inconceivable real. Okay? And because we encounter the real in different ways and at different levels, at different assemblage points of our development upward on the Kundalini ladder, we can use the same signifier in completely different ways as we grow and mature psycho-spiritually. And so we should never confuse the signifier with the concept that it's trying to express, which it can never faithfully do. So that led me to recognizing that one of the problems we have in trying to express spiritual truth in language is that language itself is a completely inadequate instrument. So we could say, il n'y a pas de rapport conceptuel réel, to use Lacan's formula and expand its significance somewhat. There is no rapport between concepts and the real. The real, by definition, which it can't be defined because it's indefinable and inexpressible inconceivable, can only be partially expressed as a kind of response to that which can never be fully known. So you cannot master the concept of the real because it's not a concept, and the real itself is unmasterable. Okay? However, what we can do is use the instrument of language and what language is pointing to that is can only be known in samadhi, in a state in which we go beyond trying to think the real and we become absorbed into the real. And that's the only way a concept, in a sense, can be mastered. It's through the surrender to the real. Because the absolute is always infinite, and the mind that uses language is always in an effort to... language is used in order to avoid the real. It's a defense against the real. This is why, in Deleuze's book on philosophy, he said it's almost impossible to create authentic concepts. Why? Because our minds are basically almost constantly engaged in mental chatter that is filled with cliches and filled with incoherences. He said most of the stream of consciousness in anyone's mind, even that of a great philosopher, is what he called bêtise. you know, which has, bet is animal, but it has nothing to do with animal. Again, it's defined in French as just stupidity. But what I would say is that because we understand the real can be divided into three categories of indescribable and inconceivable events, and we take real one to mean those events that are traumatic, that make you speechless and are overwhelmed. There is no words for it, but in a very negative or defiling or abusive or just completely invasive sense. And then the real at the next level is the impossible. It's that which is paranormal. It's strange. It becomes the uncanny, to use Freud's, one of his favorite signifiers. A very strange and weird thing happens that I cannot put into any logical form or meaning or scientific expression. It's a strangeness that leaves one hanging in the void in a certain way. And then, of course, this is all within variations of real one, and then in real two, it's the divine. It's that realization, for example, of divine love coming to you when you've never felt love in your life, and suddenly you're filled with love that's uncanny, but in a celestial, divine, beautiful, ecstatic way. And wisdom comes to you from a source that you don't know, but it's not your own mind. It's being downloaded into your mind from a higher source. And divine, uncreated light, you become aware of the light of God, that it's real. This is not a theory. It's not a dogma. It's not some religious system. It's not a metaphor. It's real. And then you get to real three. If you get into a state of total samadhi in which you transcend the mind and you transcend the whole structure of the individual consciousness and even that of the soul into and become the infinite, then you're in that absolute real that is not only totally inexpressible, but totally life-changing. And that brings the swaha, that brings the gate, gate, paragate, parasam gate to the end, complete. And it's a kind of knowledge, but it's knowledge that can never be intellectually formulated. I don't know why I brought a bunch of books with me, but I did. And let's see if I brought the one I'm looking at. This is a book of essays on Deleuze, and by Dan Smith. That's what it's called, Essays on Deleuze. Not a very creative title, but it's a fantastic book if you want to know his concepts. And in one of his essays, he quotes Nietzsche, who, remember, is famous for God is dead, and we have to become Übermenschen, but there's no God to help us there. And in Nietzsche's notebooks, there's a passage that reads as follows. A thought comes up in me. Where from? How? I simply don't know. It comes independently of my will, usually surrounded and obscured by a mass of feelings, desires, aversions, and other thoughts. One pulls it out of this mass, cleans it off, sets it on its feet, and then see how it stands and how it walks. All of this in an astonishing presto, and yet without any sense of hurry. But just who does all this? I have no idea. And I am surely more of a spectator than the originator of this process. Okay? So here's the guy who says there's no God, but he's downloading from a higher intelligence all of his best ideas. And he admits it, but he doesn't know. Where do they come from? And so that unknowability is in some way compensated by having a paradigm that is open to the reception in a maximalist kind of way of that higher intelligence, higher power, higher energies, literally, Shakti, higher divine love, light, joy, all of signatures of the supreme real that's inconceivable. So I want to present then the idea of the concept as actually needing to be divided into three. Because in nearly every mystical tradition, especially the Christian, most famous for that, there is an apophatic approach to the real, a cataphatic approach, and a cataphatic. I'm going to add a third one, which is a pragmatic. So I want to present three concepts. The apophatic, which is basically the mystic's view that, you know, nothing can be said about God, about the real. It's too amazing, too huge, too impossible to try to put into phenomenal plain language. And so the mystics of the apophatic tradition tend to say only what God is not, and create unconcepts and negative negative formulas to keep you from falling into the illusion that you understand God when you can't. And so it is more or less a guideline to say, don't fall into taking a metaphor or a signifier for the real. Don't think, oh, God is the Father and therefore God is an old guy on a cloud or something. No, that's just a metaphor for Sunday school kids to try to create some sense in the concrete thinking mind that's in the imaginary register to have some sense of piety and devotion and love for that supreme reality. But if you want to believe in that, it's no better than believing in Santa Claus or one of these other, you know, metaphors that we use with children. If we want to go beyond that, then probably the best we can do as an apophatic concept would be the inconceivable. Okay, so that would be the concept, because that's as close as you can get to the real, which is what Anandi said, the no concept, but it is the inconceivable in a certain way as a demand to go beyond all concepts if you want to know God, because you can only know God through being, not through thinking. Okay. So that is, I think, the apophatic. Then the cataphatic, I think, is someone did say it. I think you said I, right? I think I, aham, is the main metaphor that is used in Indian philosophy. Aham, or as Ramana put it, aham, aham, I am I, because there is no other. Interestingly, I was reading a book by Nicholas of Cusa, which I was reading online. I don't have it on in book form, but I have this book of the doctrine of theosis in Nicholas of Cusa. It's called Becoming God. He is one of the canonical Christian mystics, not of the apophatic, but of the cataphatic variety, and one of the great Christian mystics. And he wrote a book called No Other. And he said that the best name of God that we could give is No Other, which, you know, sounds strange in the beginning, but then if you ask what is God, God is no other than whatever you might be pointing at, because there is no other of God. God is I, and every I is God, and every phenomenon, every event, every unfoldment of the explicate order is a manifestation of God. So we can make a cataphatic formula, God equals I, and we can say that when you use the word I, probably you are using it only at the level of the signifier as a commonplace meaning that Heidegger would call the meaning das Mann would give it, the common man. That's just, you know, the kind of a level of thought that goes into your driver's license or that kind of thing. This is who I am, and, you know, it's got a picture of your face or how it looked whenever that was taken with a horrible camera. But, you know, it's either your body image or it's the name and the personality strategy, whatever. But it's always the I has to do with consciousness identified with the body. So when somebody asks you something, you say, okay, I'll do it, you know, or I won't do it, or let me think about it. But it's always I as a body will take care of this or not. But it doesn't have to do with what is really meant by I. Do you ever really reflect on what you mean by I? Because surely you don't just mean your body image or your actual organism or even the mental apparatus of your ego, God forbid. Why? Because almost all of the thoughts, the bêtise that comes, that is in the mental stream of the ego, and is made of projections and ultimately before that of introjections. Your whole ego was made out of the demands of the other in infancy and childhood and a reaction to those demands. And so the I turns into, at the ego level, a dyad or an argument between infant I and superego, other, and the voice of the other is usually saying, you're a worthless piece of something and you are this or that, or you are the golden handcuffed one who belongs to me and you can never leave. Or it has some relation to the bodily self and its attitudes and orientations toward the phenomenal plane that have nothing to do with consciousness. It's an apparatus with certain algorithms of reactivity that are robotic in nature. So not only, like Nietzsche, do we not know where our inspirations come from, the ones that are authentic concepts from that supreme intelligence, but where do our own thoughts that we think are our own, just because they come with the I signifier, really are the thoughts of the other and of the inversion and identification with that other. And there is no actual originality in the ego level of consciousness, because it's made of the fantasies projected into your consciousness in childhood in order to control you and to cause you to adapt to the family system and then the social system, etc. So it's a complete fabrication. It cannot be who you really are. And it ends up just covering over who you are. And until you start asking, but who am I deeper within than that ego that is always thinking those stupid thoughts? What is my real self? What is in my real heart? Not the emotional reactions that I have based on past sanskaras that cause me to see reality not as it is, but as it maybe once was or how I once perceived it, and I repeat again and again in slightly different versions, but have nothing to do with the real. So until we recognize that our signifiers are actually falsifiers at the level of ego, until we explore them deeply, and what philosophy is and what science is are both attempts to explore deeply the signifieds. And then it really becomes clear that we don't know anything. Like quantum physics today recognizes, and I'm sure you've all seen, you know, videos or read articles from physics teachers online, etc., that have said very clearly it is now understood by physics that space and time are illusory. And our thought that space and time is fundamental or even real has to be eliminated from physics. But do you really think, can you grok the fact that science is telling you there's no such thing as time or space? I mean, it's really extraordinary if you will get into a consciousness that eliminates those beliefs. It changes entirely your way of perceiving reality. But how many will take that seriously? But it is very serious. And once you do take it seriously, you will get to that place of inconsciousness that realizes the truth that there is no space and time. There is eternity and infinity. But it's dimensionless or of infinite dimensionality. But it has there's no construct that can express it. In the same way that you could see a movie on your computer screen, but it comes from a USB and the whole movie is on this little chip. And if you were able to read the chip directly, you'd have the whole movie instantaneously. But the computer plays it out in succession, in a linear way, so it seems like it takes time and space for this thing to unfold. But of course, the space is unreal. It's two-dimensional screen imitating a three-dimensional reality that you have to imagine. And most of how you would have to appreciate a film is by interpreting what isn't there, and turning it in your imagination into a world that's so absorbing you lose yourself in it. In the same way, this holographic movie that we're in now seems to be happening in four dimensions, or actually more than that, because the mind is not out there in the three-dimensional world, neither the thoughts nor the awareness of the thoughts. Nor the sense of the cause, the origin, the power that has created the film. And so as a character in the film, you have no free will. It's all unfolding, just like Nietzsche's thoughts are unfolding, and he's a spectator. We are all just spectators in an unfolding drama, and thinking we have some power to change things or have free will to make our own choices, etc. None of that is true. None of that is real. And then you go into a more radical understanding that there's no space or time at all. It's all happening on a chip that's completely complete. It's gate gate. It's swaha. There's nothing happening at all. So what causes the appearance of an apparent reality is our sanskaras. And the sanskaras are kind of engrams of past predispositions, which were reactions to events that occurred previously that have created attitudes and orientations and preconceptions and predispositions of and contextualizations and paradigmatic ways of perceiving that are all basically collapsed quantum and qualium wave functions. They are it's the collapse of those that create the sanskaras. And what we see as a world is simply the summation of those engrams that are appearing in this field of dreams in which they manifest. But it's all just the pure information of the sanskaras, and the sanskaras are fabrications, they're fictions. They were originally interpretations of an event that tried to express what seemed to be happening, but they're always expressions of the same sort as the famous 10 blind men trying to describe the elephant, you know. And one says it's a hose, and the other says, no, it's a big leaf, and another says it's a wall, and another says it's a pillar, et cetera, right? And so all of us are encountering the real, and we think we know it, but we've just encountered one of the tiny slivers of a past reaction to something that's not even present. So if what the spiritual sadhana, the process of liberation is the liberation from the sanskaras. We need a sanskarbonera, you know, instead of the carbonera that we're having as a very unpleasant form of smoke. We need to burn all of the sanskaras in order to see the real as it is and not through the veil of past interpretations. Because otherwise, we're almost always going to be agitated and upset. Because sanskaras are all based on desires and aversions. That's the way we react to things, pluses and minuses. And so there will be always a restlessness in the mind. And if your mind is restless and constantly chattering, you can't meditate. You can't get to know your consciousness as it is prior to and deeper within than the sanskaras. And so all you can know is a false self through the falsifiers that language creates for you. But if you want to know the real and the true, then you have to go into that level of your being that is eternal presence and not in the illusion of space and time. So that's the third category of concept, the pragmatic concept. And as you know, pragmatism is a recent philosophy, probably the only philosophy created in the United States, you know. I mean, so it's there. They're one claim to some wisdom, but pragmatism is useful, especially in its original form, discovered by Charles Sanders Peirce, one of the great thinkers, and then William James took it, but domesticated it a bit. But what I would like to do is combine pragma, which deals with phenomenal things and activities and the practical, and combine it with pragya. If we have pragma and pragya, which is the wisdom of that which is completely impractical and ineffable, and combine those, unite those, then we will have an approach to the real that will work. But what is that pragmatic approach? It is simply stillness. Okay? Your whole sadhana has to be stilling the movements of the mind, which is not only what Patanjali is famous for, but this is also the essence of Christian mysticism. It gradually took on the name of hesychasm, because the word for stillness is hezekia, and the monks, especially in the Eastern, the Greek Orthodox and the Russian Orthodox Church, famously in Mount Athos in Greece, developed a whole school of hesychasm, as it became called. And at first it was attacked as being heretical because, stilling the mind meant you were no longer praying to God. You were going beyond prayer, at least prayer of the sort that was a petition. And the later hesychasts used the Jesus prayer as their way to get to stillness. But the prayer was not the stillness. That was more like a repetition of a mantra as an interim device to finally get to a silent mind, right? So the hesychasts said that when you get your mind to a state of absolute stillness, there is an opening that happens and the uncreated light of God pours in. Now, one of the reasons that they were attacked, interestingly, from Bar Laam, one of a monk who was pretty much a dualist, is they said, how can a creature perceive the uncreated light? You see, therefore the light that you're perceiving can't be the uncreated. It has to be some secondary light or false light that's your imagination. And they said, no. It's only when your mind is active that you will fabricate the false. But when it's totally still, then the perception is a direct union with God. Theosis, which is why becoming God is such an important recognition that ultimately Christianity is a non-dualist tradition. Most people don't realize that, but especially Eastern Christianity. The goal is that state of non-dual union with God in which you are absorbed by and into the uncreated light. Now, the argument was defended by Gregory Palamas, one of the great mystics and monks of the Christian tradition. And he said, you have to understand that God can be understood as essence and as energy. And it's fascinating that this work of Gregory Palamas is identical to the work of the Abhinavagupta in the Kashmir Shaivite tradition, in which you have to understand God as both Shiva and Shakti. And Shakti is the energy of God, and Shiva is the uncreated essence that is inconceivable. But the energies are not inconceivable. You find the same in Tantric Buddhism, and you find it in Taoism. It's not no teaching has a monopoly on it. And you'll find it in some alchemical texts, and you'll find it in Hermeticism, you'll find it in Kabbalah, etc. So I want it to be clear that these concepts are universal, but they really are found in all of the traditions that we often do not associate with that realization. So the pragmatic approach requires the total silencing of the mind and the stilling of its even micro activities, its spanda, its tiny tremors of vibrational frequency, a total flatlining of mental activity. And it's in that state that the absolute reality is revealed. So, if we combine these three, the apophatic, the cataphatic, and the pragmatic, then we can, I think, get a good approach to what we must, how we must orient ourselves in a spiritual process such as Sat Yoga. And of course, the word Sat is that ultimate reality. It means the real, and it is that which is nirguna. It's without any qualities that can be expressed, and yet it also emanates prakasha and vimarsha. In other words, it emanates that uncreated, supreme, supernal light, and it emanates intelligence, infinite intelligence, and transmits that so that it becomes your own reflective awareness, and you can vibrate at that frequency. But you only vibrate at that frequency once you have transcended the lower intellect of the ego system. If you're still in that intellect and you haven't completely silenced it, then you will get a very incoherent, imaginal, phantasmatic version of spirituality and of the supreme reality rather than the true. And so what we have seen is that the universal, this unconcept is universal. And if we take what is the concept of universal mean, right? It means, it can mean either one turn, meaning one turn of the cycle of time, or it can mean turning toward the one, or the ones turning toward you. But that's what universal is, you see. And if we take it as one turn of this whole drama of appearance that is then withdrawn back into the Godhead, which it also is, that's the meaning of the swastika, that turn, the division of time into yugas. And what are the yugas? They're not actually temporal. They're differential vibrational frequencies. And we're now in the frequency that produces a Kali Yuga. And what is a Kali Yuga? It's a time where everything goes wrong. But it's a time of the uncanny. It's a time of inconceivability. But if out there, it's just the world is filled with inconceivable stupidity. Things that are inconceivably absurd, inconceivably evil, inconceivably horrific are occurring on a constant basis. But also, the inconceivable presence of God is becoming palpable in this final period. So the unreality of the phenomenal plane is becoming more palpable. Like, it can't be real. You can't make this stuff up. How many times do you hear people saying that, you know, in talk shows and videos, right? It's impossible that they could be this stupid or this whatever, right? But the, you know, it's clearly an appearance of something that is fictional, and that is a product of the collective consciousness that has fallen into a false level of its own being. But what is real in you, what is real in every being that calls itself I, is the supreme reality, because there is only that. This, by the way, is the meaning of the Sufi version of this same truth, which is the Wahdat al-Wujud, famous phrase by Ibn Arabi, the unity of being, which is even radicalized more by another Sufi named Ibn Sabayin, who referred to it as al-mutlaka, the wahdat al-mutlaka, which means the radical non-duality. It's paradvaita, as the Shaivites call it. It's the same concept, that there is only God. There is nothing but God. There is nothing but the supreme reality. And everything that you see is nothing but a manifestation of that. And if you are perceiving it as being other or different, then you're not seeing clearly or perceiving clearly what is being presented. So, the mastering of the concept means the mastering of conceptuality. In other words, the mastery over the mind, because the mind is simply a conceptualizing apparatus. And the mastery has to be the ability at will to silence and still the mind. But who has the willpower to do that? The ego doesn't have it. Why? Because the ego is made up of a bunch of desires that are based on its sanskaras and of fears. And the ego holds on tenaciously to its false narrative of the world, because it's terrified of suddenly realizing it's clueless and it has no idea who it is or what is happening or anything. And so it defends tenaciously against the silencing of the mind, because that's depersonalization. It's the end of the fictional character you've been playing, which, of course, is liberation from suffering as well. But that liberation is a threat to the ego mind that's terrified of the unknowable, the infinite, the unmasterable, and of its own. It's terrified of all of the information that will come up in the process of silencing the mind. Because you don't silence it until you have burned all the sanskaras. And that means the shadow has to come up. You know, you've got to burn not only Jekyll, but Hyde at the stake. And you've got to burn all of the forbidden knowledge and the unbearable knowledge that you pretended didn't even exist. And so, and you have to burn your own desire for freedom as an ego. That's the hardest thing to renounce, because you need freedom from the ego in order to exist as freedom itself, as consciousness that is free of being ruled over by sanskaras. But the ego that identifies with its sanskaras just wants freedom for those sanskaras to act out and to get what it wants, what your mind tells you you want, and what your emotions tell you you like and what you don't like. None of that is real, and it has to be released. Because non-duality doesn't have good and bad, right and wrong. It doesn't have that spectrum. It's before you ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's the Edenic state in which there is no ego. And so the ego resists that breakthrough into the open of the absolute reality with all of its might. Which is why you have to love God with all your might and your heart and your mind in order to overcome the ego's love of what is not God, what is not the self, what is not I, what is not real. So this is the battle that we are in until Swaha has been achieved. And the more that there is the desire to know God while alive, the desire to reach liberation from the wheel of life and death and having to deal with another Kali Yuga and deal with more karma and deal with all of the consequences of the ego's impurity. The more that you will focus on silencing the ego mind to know the mind of God, and then beyond the mind of God to the Godhead itself. So there were some other mystics I was going to read to you tonight from different books, but now it feels like maybe it's not really necessary to do that, or maybe I'll come back to them in another meeting. But I hope it's clear that putting together the inconceivable with the recognition of absolute unity, but a unity of being that integrates differences. It's not a denial of or an absconding from the world of differences. It's the achintya bhedabhada, as the Vaishnavs call it in their theology. Achintya is a very important word. In fact, it means inconceivable. So that could be our Sanskrit, you know, version of the apophatic concept. Achintya. But what is inconceivable is how non-duality and duality are one. That samsara and nirvana are one, as the Buddhists put it. Not two, not other. And it's that capacity to see that opens the field of consciousness to an entirely different logic than the two-valued logic of yes or no, true or false, right or wrong, good or bad, that the ego is stuck in, and opens one up to paradox and to what would appear contradictory to the ego mind, but is total clarity to the self that perceives that inconceivable unity of the superposition of eternity and time. The other term that is used by the yogis, more by the Advaita Vedantins, is anirvachaniya, which means it's inexpressible. So there is no way to language this inconceivable non-duality of what seem to be opposites, and that allows the coincidentia positorum, the unity of all opposites, into absolute oneness. And for that to be directly perceived by the consciousness that's no longer deceived by a false interpretive apparatus that breaks everything up into subject and object. So the payoff for silencing the mind is that one reaches immortality, one reaches bliss, one reaches wisdom, one reaches love, one reaches completion, and one reaches the ultimate fulfillment that is inexpressible, but that is the ultimate cause or impetus for all of the great art that humanity has produced. Because art, unlike philosophy or science, is not about concepts. It's about what I would call affects. It is the feeling of that non-duality that's inexpressible and inconceivable, but can be felt as bliss, as love, as joy, as a spectrum of feelings that is sublime and divine. And great art is the attempt to put that into music, painting, to put that feeling state into drama, into dance, into all of the activities in which human expression transcends language and the ordinary use of language, which is poetry. And it's that striving to express the inexpressible that I think is what impels us toward spiritual growth, toward those sublimation channels that we now should see as sublation channels, because we disappear through stilling the mind, we disappear as an ego and reappear at soul and then at absolute levels of our being. But it is through the artistic oeuvre of one who is dedicated to expressing faithfully the encounter with that supreme reality that produces art that is divine, inspiring, beautiful, that changes your life when you encounter it. And it's uncanny. It produces effects that people write books about, but they can never capture. So it's this creative impulse that produces what is most priceless in the human spirit. And yet, in order to be able to express it, the mind must be silent. And this is why the great artist has to be a meditator and to be one who is empty in shunyata in order to be filled by that inspiration. So the work of the yogi in phase one is to silence the mind and reach stillness. and egolessness. But in stage two, it's to transform what is received in that state into art, into wisdom, into the service of God in the dream field. It's not just to be kept to oneself in a cave. That can be done, and that energy will be transmitted, but the work is much more to transmit that inconceivable truth in ways that others can be inspired and uplifted and healed from their suffering, from their emotional wounds, by the power of truth. So I will stop at this point and open the floor. I think we have a microphone. If anyone here wants to ask a question or make a comment about any of this, and I hope it was useful to you. It was a little intellectual for something that is about not being able to have concepts, but I think it was necessary to express conceptually why the limitation of thought and language is the frontier that we must cross in order to reach the real. Because if otherwise we're within the event horizon of the ego bubble, we will never know ourselves. We will never know our own powers, the energies of God, and we won't know our own essence as God, as I. And that is what life's purpose really is, according to every religion. No other purpose for our being. So the floor is open if anyone has anything they would like to contribute or ask about. And also on the love stream, Purusha, do you want to say anything about our love streaming sangha this evening?
So welcome everyone who's joining us online. We have people joining us from the UK, Sweden, Ethiopia, the US, the Netherlands, Canada, Australia, Portugal, Germany, Costa Rica, the Czech Republic, Switzerland, Brazil, and Belgium. And we're very happy to have you with us for this retreat.
Welcome all.
Maybe while we're waiting for the first question, we just had one that came in. Rumi says, keep breaking your heart until it opens. I would love to hear Shunyamurti's take on this.
Well, in a certain way, life is about heartbreak. And if you haven't had your heart broken, then you haven't lived. You haven't loved. But the problem is that for most people, their hearts are broken very early in life. Before they even know what heartbreak is, it's broken by a breaking of the love bond and the trust bond between the infant and the mother. And these days, that can happen for lots of reasons, including the mother being ambivalent about whether to have a child or to abort, which creates trauma in the fetus even before birth. Many women have children via C-section, and that has effects upon the child's consciousness and can produce a trauma and a cut. And if a child is premature and it has to go into, you know, one of those heat boxes for a while, and if it's separated from the mother and doesn't bond right away, it can create a kind of a heartbreak that is immediately defended against through a kind of a paranoid, schizoid, avoidant and defensive attitude, which can lead to narcissism, but also to autism or even psychosis or other other mental disorders that are created by the sensor's distrust of the dream field, the others upon whom its life depends. And so if heartbreak happens too early, what it will lead to is a very closed and defended heart that will rarely open again. And then this becomes, it's compensated for by a personality strategy that is often going to create a superiority complex, etc. But it will produce a wound that can almost never be healed if that happens too early. And the same is true after the perinatal phase when abuse can happen in physical ways, sexual ways, other ways of abuse and of neglect and of a non-present, non-loving mothering. And then later an abusive and dictatorial fathering can produce the same closure, but there it happens at a later date that produces a different psychological effects. But when one has taken the risk of love and one's heart is broken as an adult, there is the possibility of an opening at that point to the real, because the pain is such of an unbearable sort that I mean, this is what brings most people into psychotherapy, actually, but it's also what brings people to use drugs and anti-anxiety medications and all kinds of self-medicating, alcoholism, etc., ways of deadening the pain. But I think that the heartbreak is in some sense, when it happens, as part of the hero's journey, as part of one's spiritual questing that is a rite of passage beyond the level of the heart that is identified with the ego, that has to break open into a kind of a depersonalization state in order to be open to the presence of that reality that cannot be known from within the consciousness of a heart that feels okay, but is still within its finite prison of the ego paradigm and has never encountered divine love or the infinite love of God. So it can often be a moment of conversion. And it's often after a heartbreak that you find people join monasteries and ashrams, and they can only focus on contemplation as a mode of healing what has made them dysfunctional in terms of being able to relate to others. And this is when solitude becomes and it becomes attractive rather than repulsive to most people who would rather cling on to others. And it's in that yearning for a kind of solitude in which one is free of the ego's pain. And this is the real shunyata, the real emptiness, that one is then healed completely from the ego itself. So I hope that answers your question. Is there anyone else here who would like to say anything or ask anything.
Thank you once again. I found it very useful what you mentioned about the ego fighting with all its might. And it was just a useful reminder to know that, okay, this is the battle. And it's going to do everything it can to not stay in silence. And I've been noticing that going on.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about the burning of the sanskaras.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, you mentioned these micro thoughts going on, or these subtle
mm-hmm.
Agitations going on in the mind.
Yeah.
When that is happening, that's my question, is there then already a burning of the sanskaras going on, or is that only like an initial level that will then lead to deeper parts of the shadow being burned and et cetera?
No, that's not, I wouldn't say that's the burning, that's the expression of those more subtle sanskaras.
Mm-hmm.
When the mind is stilled, that's when they burn.
Mm-hmm.
The stilling of them produces an internal friction in them. They can't express themselves, and they begin to vibrate in such a way that they just incinerate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You see, but it requires the refusal of all desire. And this is why dispassion is considered the highest state, really, just prior to liberation, vairagya. It's that state where there are not even any micro desires left. The mind reaches total stillness. Otherwise, you're never going to be in that state. And those micro movements of impulses, if you pay attention to them, they can expand. They can become real drives, and suddenly I want this or that, or I have some train of thought that is taking me completely out of meditation into some narrative or some reverie or fantasy, and one loses the thread of one's intention. So, but if you can observe them, it means you have reached the state of relative silence. If you can observe those subtle levels, and you're no longer getting the more palpable, obtuse levels of actual memories and emotions, etc., coming up. So it means that you're getting to a deeper state of the sanskaric engram, and then finally at silence, then it will burn.
Mm.
Okay.
And then in that silence, when those agitations have stopped, is then the power of God there sufficiently to keep one there more easily, or is it still this intense pull that's going on?
Well, the more of your desire is for desirelessness,
mm-hmm.
The more that the presence of the grace of God becomes your own empowered state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because remember, God is I. And the more you are in the real I, not the signifier of I that comes from thoughts, but the real I, the more that the power of God is your own power to burn the sanskaras, yes, and reach freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Thank you.
Right.
That helps.
Good. How many people found this talk helpful in some way? Yeah? Okay, well, I'm glad. Do you have another question online?
Yes, from Jorge, who says, you mentioned to go into a space of non-space and non-time. I have gone into this space, but it's always for a very short moment. How can one stay in this space?
Mm. Well, this is what the sadhana is about. In the beginning, it will be very intermittent, and there will be a fall back into mental chatter. But the more that you have the taste of that divine love and the power of the light and the wisdom that comes, the more that you want more of it. You become a glutton for God, and all the other forms of gluttony are given up because this is better food than whatever you could get through the senses and through thought. So it's a matter of practicing until you have established yourself there, that this is your second nature, but your return to your real original nature. And there's no effort any longer required. The effort now is required to come out of samadhi or into, you know, some state of concentrated thought about a problem that requires a different skill set than that of transcendence. And so the shift can happen gradually, or it can happen instantaneously when you realize you are not the ego trying to meditate. There is actually no one trying to meditate. That's part of the illusion, you see? And that's a sanskara of trying to meditate. But the only real I is already God. There is no other I but that. And when you realize that's I, There's no meditation any longer necessary or possible or interesting. You are that. I am that is, right? Tatwa masi. That's the formula. And once that's been realized, then all practice is obsolete.
It was an absolutely beautiful and enriching teaching.
Why, thank you.
And one of the things that everything stuck out, but the apophatic understanding that the only thing that can be said is what God is not. Mm-hmm. It's something that I've been feeling in terms of not knowing or not realizing yet the inconceivable, but feeling in my heart what God is not, mm-hmm. right? That the conflict and, you know, any kind of disunity is not God. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciated very much you bringing that information. And in terms of how then this grows, right, in terms of a rise in consciousness to God, you had taught a few days ago about the ethical sublation mm-hmm. channel, mm-hmm. and that's how I resonated with mm-hmm. Perhaps discernment that mm-hmm. the thoughts that may rise in one's mind are not God's thoughts. Mm-hmm. And that it's unethical certainly, especially to identify with them, because that really mm-hmm. stings. So that has been quite a journey I've been on in meditations lately, as well that I think have led me to. Remembering or recall, or as Nietzsche said, where did this thought come from? But the I, just that I, comes to mind, and then that cancels, you know, well, I guess they say cancel culture, but it cancels all of that ego's culture, mm-hmm. The sanskaras, and so it's been very helpful have that, I feel it's grace that just reminds me of that I, and allows then that stillness to come in. And the other thing you mentioned, what you said about Sat Yoga really being that integration of the pragyani, the truth, and the practical. I have certainly experienced that it's in the multiplicity, seemingly multiplicity of seeming differences in which the opportunity to see what sanskaras are still running through. In a cave, right? You don't have that much of a chance, perhaps. You have to come out of the cave.
That's true.
To know to feel that sting of the ethical that is not purified.
Yes.
And so all of this, perhaps to contextualize my question, how to proceed from here?
Mm. Well, okay. Thank you, Mataji. It's, of course, the question, how to move forward from wherever you are. And remember, we say there are three reels. So reel two, I think, is the key. And reel two is the reel of divine love. So the more one is willing to be forgiving, and forgiving is to give forth your love to the other, seeing the eye of God within the otherness of the apparent ego, and holding on to no projections. Oh, this is not a nice person. This one's not friendly. This one is this or that. You have no attitudes toward the other, because the other is yourself. And whatever you're seeing negative in the other is a projection of what's in your own shadow. Otherwise, you wouldn't perceive it. And so the elimination of your shadow, the burning of it, through love and forgiveness, and the surrendering to God, knowing that we all need forgiveness for whatever trespasses, impurities, lack of love we have behaved with in the past, to burn our own karma and our own sanskaras, to receive that grace, there is a humbling. And it's only when there's a complete state of humility, without any sense of entitlement, or I deserve this because, you know, and no hierarchization or class system or the use of phenomenal plane attributes, whether it's looks or youth or money or whatever else, to try to establish some power, territory, control. It's always a letting go of all of that into it's thy will, not mine, be done, and a complete hollowing out of any egoic intentionality, to be filled by the will of God and the word of God. Okay.
A follow-up on that. So what I've been noticing is an acceleration of sitting in meditation and burning those sanskaras, and that the actual appearance of disunity, right, is accelerating. That
disunity internally, you're meaning?
Well, ultimately, it's
ego,
internal.
Superego disunity.
Yeah,
perhaps?
Ultimately, it's mm-hmm. it's there. I can usually trace it right to that. Yeah. And one thing I really noticed this time, which I hadn't in these last few weeks, is actually And I wanted to ask you, is it superego, or can it also be a big other ego disunity? Because there's a lot of cultural differences.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right?
That's the social superego.
Yeah.
Which gets internalized as a superego voice.
Right. So that's what I've been noticing. Mm-hmm. It's even beyond the superego, but a social superego that has its ideas about, what's culturally correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which is always inauthentic, but still, it's the program. Mm-hmm. And the force that has, I can perhaps speak about it tonight because I've been more aware of it. Mm-hmm. It's as if there's even more of a current.
Well, the cancel culture that you mentioned, that's what that is. Mm-hmm. They intimidate you if you have a politically incorrect thought or attitude. And of course, everything of traditional values is now incorrect. So, it's there in the energy field of the phenomenal plane that attacking and intimidating force is present.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. Oh, we're out of non-existent time. So I hope this is useful and that you do focus on the fact that the I that you are is inconceivable. And you can't know yourself through any narrative or any image or any memory or any superego voice or any signifier. You can only know yourself when the mind is silent and still and the real self emerges. And that's when life begins, authentic life, divine life. So use the pragmatic practice of silencing the mind through love of the real self, through the yearning to know, through the one desire to be desireless and in stillness and in a state of essence rather than becoming. And in that state, the absolute unity of being will be revealed, and its divine, ecstatic, joyous beauty will be revealed as well, and life will become rather than a hell realm or a bardo state of the ego, becomes a perfection of the kingdom of heaven within that then is perceived also without. So let us, by reaching that state, a certain energy enters the morphogenic field, and then at some point for the collective consciousness, the world shifts from Kali Yuga to the next Sat Yuga. And it's this transfiguration of reality as an expression of the real that comes out of concealment, and the divine light washes away the apparent material world, which is frozen light and nothing other than that, and reconfigures its quantum and qualium wave functions to present itself to itself in perfect beauty. And may we all be the artists of that creation. Namaste.
You have announcements, Swati, huh?